ready to roll. Before we get phone calls lined up, we talked about this a little bit yesterday on our coverage. Some things happen over the weekend that elicit questions from a historical nature, and we touched on this a little bit.
Okay.
And Tony Kanaan struggles. He ultimately made the race, but it reminded us of a few other scenarios. I think everyone knows the 95 story with Penske, but a few others going back, Bobby Rahal.
Yeah.
A couple of times. In 94, I recall, he... Did he change cars?
He did.
Yeah.
In fact, in 94 was a kind of a different situation where he'd been there in 93. Now, I think he had Honda engines in 93. I just remember it was the True Sport chassis.
He was starting the Honda program.
The Honda program was brand new, and I know he had it in 94, and I think he had it in 95, but maybe not. But he had the True Sports in 93. And there were two of them, and he was trying to do it. Bless his heart, he was trying to do it with an American-built chassis. It didn't work out. He got bumped, and with the backup car, tried to get back in on the last day. And I think the first two laps were right where he needed to be. I don't remember if he was over or under, but I mean, it was just a tick either way. And then the third lap was quite a bit slower. That drug was averaged down, and then he. The fourth lap, it wasn't fast enough to get in, and I think that was still the Ilmor engine. So he came the next year. This is what it was. Then he was the developmental driver and would have been the house team for Honda, and he was here with two cars. Mike Groff was in the other, and they both qualified, but they didn't think it was going to hold up. And rather than stick it out, he thought, I missed the show last year, and I can't miss the show again with all of the sponsor obligations I've got. And so he elected to go to, he acquired two other cars from, I think, from Penske. And then they withdrew both the Mike Groff time and his, and then they went out and qualified. Now, they were going to get bumped anyway, but they did actually withdraw. And then, as a result of that, he made the race and finished third, but he lost the Honda dealership, lost the Honda deal because they thought, well, our driver ditched us, so we'll go with somebody else. But he did, he just figured, well, I came to make the race, and I'm not going to, and I can't miss it 2 years in a row.
I did look up in the box score yesterday when we brought this up, and it was a Penske Ilmor that he ended up in.
Yeah.
And then we
Roger
want to get to,
Ward in 65
yeah, we want to get to other phone calls, but I think you can kind of just describe the situation succinctly in by giving his record in the whatever it was 6 years leading up to 1965, and then he had a crash, and so circumstances led to him missing the race, but the record from what starting in I know he won in 59 was he up at the front in 58 as well?
No.
So starting in 59 to 64.
Yeah, he had two firsts, two seconds, a third, and a fourth. So fourth was his first worst finish in six straight races. And then 65, on the first day, he waved off an attempt that would have been fine, but they were going for the front row. And then they kept changing things, and it kept, they're getting further out of it. And then it ended up on his third strike. He completed the four laps. On the last day, at like quarter to six, I mean, the shadows were long, and he was not fast enough to get in. He was the first alternate starter, and I mean, that was pretty stunning at the time.
Yeah. Okay, telephone calls for Donald. 239-1070 is our telephone number. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan, and Mark begins us this evening.
Hello, Mark.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Good.
I didn't hear the first part of your commentary, Donald, so I hope you didn't already answer my question, but I was wondering, yesterday, had a wrecked, immobile car sitting in the garage that never bumped itself back to the show.
Well, not quite under these circumstances, no. I mean, there's been cars that qualified. No, not. The answer is no. Cars have qualified and then gone out and then crashed, running presumably fuel tests, and started on race day anyway. But to actually have what happened with Sebastian Saavedra, in a nutshell, was he was sitting 33rd, decided we better get out there and in case we need to make another attempt, crashed, building up to speed, but was still in the field, But then in the meantime, he's on his way to the hospital. And then I don't know why I'm laughing at that because it's not funny. And then he did get bumped. Somebody withdrew to put him back in the field. He got bumped again. And then somebody else withdrew, which I suppose would be Jay Howard at the last minute. When he withdrew, he was in the field.
I think he was bumped at least three times.
Well, I could think of two.
Roman Cini withdrew.
That would put him back.
Tracy
in, yeah.
withdrew, and mm-hmm. Howard withdrew.
Okay, but would that, I'm not sure. Would that have put? Yeah, I guess if he was on the bubble when he had the accident, then he would have been bumped each time and then reinstated.
Yeah. Now they did get to a point where Howard was bumped at one point as well. So at one point he would have been 35th, and then with Tracy and Howard withdrawing, mm-hmm. that's how he got back up to 33rd.
Okay, I should have rehearsed this better. Maybe when Tracy, in fact, did Tracy withdraw, which put Howard back in? Maybe that's what happened.
Yes,
and then Tracy wasn't fa- then did
then
did
Tracy
two laps
was
and
not
came
fast
in,
enough. Uh-huh.
So that leaves Howard in, and then Howard withdraws, and that puts Saavedra back in. So anyway, but in answer to the caller's question, no, I don't remember anything like that before. That was crazy. But and maybe it doesn't make a sense to a lot of people, but under the way the rules are written, I mean, the officials did absolutely the right thing.
And they're
all right, Andy.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mark, and this will come up later on, too, and I got a lot of emails today about confusion. Several emails think that not only were we wrong on the radio, TV was wrong.
TV was
wrong. Brian Barnhart, yeah. They had the wrong time. Now, maybe you understand this. This is what I'll start with, but there's confusion about Howard getting a chance to go back out, and some think that he withdrew earlier than he did. What happened was he got bumped. Mm-hmm. That's why he was able to get back in mm-hmm. after he was bumped. Tracy withdrew a time. That's why he couldn't get back in. There was some question on which speed is the one that counted for Howard. The original time that stood at 5:30 or whatever was 223.824. Mm-hmm. Then he, after he got bumped, did a 223.6, I think it was, which was just a touch slower mm-hmm. than Sebastian Saavedra. The question then came after Tracy withdrew, which speed went back in the field? Mm-hmm. Which speed was reenacted? And it had to be the original speed, the 8.24, to put him above Saavedra, because if it was the second speed that he had qualified with at 5.45, mm-hmm. that was slower than mm-hmm. Saavedra. So obviously the thinking is, the rationale is, well, he didn't choose to withdraw that time. He didn't choose to go back out. He only went back out because mm-hmm. he was forced to, mm-hmm. so we should not make him take the slower. Mm-hmm. He should be able to keep the faster speed.
I
hope that makes sense. Yeah. And
it does
then me. He withdrew at 5:57 or whatever it was.
When you withdraw, you wipe it out.
Then you're done. Mm-hmm. And then that's because he wanted to simply put the matter in his own hands. Paul mm-hmm. Tracy was right behind him. And he thought, well, I'd rather do this. And the team thought, we think he can go quick enough. Rather than sit there and be helpless and watch Paul Tracy bump us, then let's go ahead and do it. So that's the situation, and we'll continue to address that in the next hour.
Okay.
239-1070 is the telephone number. And Steve, you are next.
Hello, Steve.
Hi, Donald.
Hi.
The other evening you were talking about Gene Marcinak.
Yes.
And he won with Fred Frame in 1932.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think he joined the Novi team in 1947 when they built the second car.
I think that's probably right, yeah.
Do you know who or which cars or teams he might have worked on between 1932 and 1947?
No. I was thinking about that when I was doing his profile the other night. He was on Lockhart's winning crew in 26. I don't think he was a chief mechanic, but he was on that crew. Then he was on Ray Keach's winning team in 29, Billy Arnold's in 30, and Fred Frame's in 32. So he was on four winning teams. And then I got thinking after I was onto the profile, I thought, you know what? I've got a gap here. So I can't tell you what teams he was on. I'm assuming that he came back every year. And then once he was on with the Novi team, and I think probably that's right, because Bud Winfield was the chief mechanic, and they had the one car in 46, Novice we're talking about. And I know he's not in any of the photographs in 46, but when in 47, when they had the second car, I mean, it's possible, having said that about that he came back every year, maybe there was a few years when he didn't. That's hard to believe, but I think that, in the profile I did, I was talking about the fact that he was employed by Warner Brothers. I mean, he actually had a job outside of, just purely being a chief mechanic. Not that anybody could make a full-time living on that in those days, but he did work for the Warner Brothers Transportation Department along with Ernie Olsen and under Art Klein. And then I assume that he probably came back every May. Having said that... I've got a block there or a gap. My guess is he probably stayed with Harry Hartz. This is just a guess. Harry Hartz had Frank Briscoe and Fred Frame, and then he had Ted Horn in 36, 37, 38. My guess is that Marcinak probably was on that team.
Okay.
Well, that's kind of what I wondered if he didn't, but...
Well, I'll research that a little bit further because I forgot to do that after the call the other night. So I'll check up on that, and thank you for reminding me that I needed to do that.
Thank you, Steve. Mike is up with us next with Donald Davidson.
Hello, Mike.
Hi, guys. Hey, I had a question. I heard a rumor that Mel Torme sang Back Home Again in Indiana once. Is that accurate?
Yes, 1961.
Oh, cool.
He actually attended the race several times. As a true enthusiast, there was none of this, I've never had this opportunity before. He came several times.
Wasn't encouraged to come, wasn't negotiated through his agent,
he came.
Hang
out in the pits and knew who the drivers were. Yeah. There's a lot of photographs to substantiate that. And why he only sang it once, I don't know, because he was here several times, but 61 was the only year he did it.
Okay. Hey, and I had a suggestion for when and if... Jim Nabors retires from that slot. Mike Rowe off of TV's Dirty Jobs is an operatic singer and with a great personality. I'd love to see him belting that tune out for us.
All right. I have no idea if any thought has been given to the future or not. I mean, it used to be. Now they look ahead some. But in the Tony Holman days, a lot of those things were done at the last minute. In fact, Jim Nabors' version is that they came and got him out of the grandstands on race morning in 72. I don't know if that can exactly be right, but that's what Jim claims.
Was he here for the parade or similar circumstances?
He was Bill Harrah's guest.
Okay.
And he says they came and got him out of the grandstands, and then he further says that he didn't know, I think he thought he was going to sing on the banks of the Wabash or maybe the... I don't think it was the national anthem. But anyway, he didn't realize he was going to sing Back Home Again in Indiana, and then he had to quickly write the lyrics down on an envelope. And
Boy, that would be a tough call. Yeah. My first thought is I'm okay with the recording, at least for a while, if Jim's not available.
Mm-hmm.
And they did do that 2 or 3 years ago when
he couldn't come,
had some minor health issues, obviously, that he recovered from, and they played it on the PA there.
They were going to... I think were they going to have him on screen? They were going to put the words up or something.
Yeah, and there was some sort of a technical glitch.
There was a technical glitch of some kind, but the idea was that the audience would sing it.
Yeah,
and that had happened once before in 1955. I don't know if anybody else did this, but in 1955, Dinah Shore did a slightly longer version. Because right now, if you've ever timed that, it only runs about 35 seconds, and the song is longer than that.
Sure.
And I think Dinah Shore did a longer version. Anyway, she asked the crowd to join her, and if you hear that on the broadcast, it's really effective.
Is it the second verse that we hear, or is this the first verse?
I can't tell you that.
For some reason, I was thinking, I've seen the lyrics, and another verse goes first, but I may be way off on that.
There's also an opening. You know Jenny Nicol?
No.
At Langner, long time at Langner.
I'm
sure you do.
Okay.
Anyway, never mind. But she sings. She can do the whole thing. And there's a what do you call it? Would it be preamble? There's like a there's an introduction, which is a, which is
maybe that's what I'm thinking
music.
Of. This
and,
is
and
a,
then it leads
the
into
chorus.
The song. Yeah, the
yeah.
chorus.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. 239-1070 is our telephone number. Questions for Donald Davidson. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan.
Patients save on average 54% and $6 million monthly with coupons from IndyDrugCard.com. Save on your next refill. Get your free Indy Drug Card instantly. Print it.
It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan with Donald Davidson. I'm Kevin Lee. Full phone lines. Whenever you hear someone hang up, jump on board. 239-1070 is the telephone number. Eric is up next.
Yes, gentlemen, thank you for taking my call. Donald, I wanted to ask you, what was the oldest car to qualify for the 500? And I wondered if you could do a profile on Gordon Johncock. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, the first question first. That's easy. In 1948, a car called the Clark Auto Company Special, driven by Doc Williams, actually was one of the 1927 Coopers. Yes, 27.
Wow.
So it was 21 years old. Wow. And it had been in the race several times in different forms. It was rebodied and so on. But as I understand it, the chassis was still was in the race 21 years after it was new.
How did it do?
It dropped out early.
No.
And then the other thing, too, that shows how things are different is the Clark Auto Company Special was... three or four lots. It wasn't just one lot. There was about three of them in town, Indianapolis, but they were used car lots. It wasn't even a new car dealer sponsoring a car in the 500. And, you know, that was, I don't know if that might have been like a $500 deal or something. And the car actually was back the next year and didn't make it.
How many cars tried to qualify in 48? How many did that car have to beat out, approximately?
Oh, there were five that completed the distance and didn't, either got bumped or completed runs that were too slow. And then a bunch of others that waved off. Yeah. So how many different cars took the green? I'm just guessing, probably 44 different cars. Yeah.
Gordon Johncock?
All right, Johncock, yeah. I'll do the short one on that. Rather than go year by year and car by car, he won the tragic rain shortened race in 1973 ended up with his teammate, Swede's Average, eventually succumbed to injuries sustained that day. And then also they lost a crew member who was, ran across the track when he saw the Savage accident and was hit by a rescue vehicle that was roaring up to go to the scene. And rather than belabor all of that, he was able to come back and win the 1982 race. It took 9 years for him to get the second victory. But I always say that he went from winning the race that everybody wanted to forget to the one that nobody could forget.
Mm-hmm.
And really, just already off the tangent a little bit, I know that the 73 race was so grim, it ran on the third day, and there was rain delayed, and then they had all the accidents, and it was just a terrible, terrible month, and everybody sort of kind of disappeared, and the victory banquet was canceled, and during the summer, it was sort of like around, you know, July, August, they started to get letters from friends that said, you know what, you did win it. Your face will be on the BorgWarner Trophy. We wanted to forget the whole thing, but by golly, you are an Indianapolis 500 winner. But he thought, well, it needs to be validated with me doing one that goes 500 miles in this lot. Tragedy, and it looked like that was going to happen in 77 when he was leading late in the race, and it was I remember him going out of the pits, just going, and I thought, boy, that doesn't sound very good. It sounded like it was overstressing the engine. And I don't remember what the mechanical problem was, but he came by, I think he went by one time, and then the next time was rolling down the inside of the, by the pit wall, and 16 laps to go, and then into the lead goes A.J. Foyt, who goes on to win his fourth. Johncock's first year was 65 when he drove a Watson Roadster. It was the St. Carl Lloyd Ruby driven to third the year before, and he finished fifth, the Weinberger Home Special. So that was the last year that front-engine cars finished within the first 10. There was a couple more that appeared after that, but that was basically 65 was the last hurrah. And so Johncock is one of 14 drivers living who drove a front-engine car in the 500s. It's alarming that there's only 14. Anyway, rather than labor that, he went from the fifth in 65 to a fourth in 66, 12th in 67, but actually that was running, I think, like seventh or eighth, and he had a tire go or something, and a minor wall contact late in the race. He dropped out in 68 and 69 and 70 and 71. And in 70, several of those years, he drove his own, it was his own team. There was the John Cock race team for a while. Gilmore Broadcasting. In fact, Jim Gilmore, his first sponsorship was of John Cock in 1967. John Cock was already on the outside of the front row when the sponsorship came in. So that's what he ran on race day. And then in 71, he drove for Rollof Allstead with one of the 1970 McLarens. And then in 72, he was on the McLaren team. He was Peter Revson's teammate on Team McLaren, but he didn't finish that one. And then 73, then he went to Patrick Racing Team, where he stayed through 85. And in addition to winning the race in 73 in the rain, he got a fourth in 74. He was an early out in 75, third in the rain in 76. And then we mentioned that he was leading late and then still got an 11th place finish, but he dropped out leading in 77. And then he was third in 78, sixth in 79, fourth in 80, dropped out running actually when, I'm dragging up another one here with the Bobby Unser and Mario Andretti dispute in 81. Am I going to explain that? No. But I think I think John Cock was actually running between the two of them. So I think he dropped out running second, but ended up with a ninth place finish there. Then he won the 82 race, thank goodness. And then 83, 84, didn't finish. 85, he practiced, and then on the eve of the first qualifying day announced his retirement. And I wonder how long that'll last. And, yeah. and it actually lasted 2 years because he was back and, 87 made the race, 80 qualified and got bumped. And then he was in 89, 90, 91, and 92. And, a little anecdote, but we need to take a break here about the,
Go ahead. 91.
All right. Real quick. In 91, he was, I don't know that he'd even come to the track. And Jonathan Bird and Ron Hemelgarn had a car that was a Carsworth, and they wanted Johnny Rutherford to drive it. They talked to Al, and Al declined because he didn't have a ride that year. He thought, no. Johnny Rutherford, no, I don't want to drive a Carsworth. So they called John Cock. Hemelgarn called John Cock. He was out on his tractor plowing the field when he got the call. And so anyway, he came down and started 33rd. Then he had flu. There was some concern that he was going to be able to drive in the race. They had Johnny Parsons standing by to drive, either start or at least be a relief driver, and John Cock stayed out there all day. And I remember throughout the broadcast, because Johnny Rutherford was the driver expert, mm-hmm. and so when we said, hey, John, you're on a break, we'd say, you're running 15th right now. Your car is 15th, or your car is 12th. And then it ended up right at the end, Mario dropped out with like a couple of laps to go, and John Cock, from the white flag to taking the checker, went from 7th to 6th. And that's when Johnny finally got it. And I said, hey, John, you finished 6th. And he goes, That's when it really finally sung in. But anyway, that is a true story. John Cock was plowing a field on a tractor when he got the call, come down and see if you want to qualify this thing.
Did he try in 93? Trying to remember.
No. He was looking.
He was around,
yes,
as I remember.
He was looking, and in fact, really about the last shot was in 94, and this is when the first time when we really heard ethanol, and this is going to sound like a joke, he had a bunch of people that went to USAC, and they wanted to run ethanol, and USAC said, well, no, you know, we're only doing methanol right now, and he had this group of people that wanted to do this team, backed by the ethanol industry, and mm-hmm. They were going to, this, I'm not joking, they wanted to paint the car up like an ear of corn, but they said no, so that was the end of it. And but by golly, by that time, I mean, he was like 50, 55, 56 years old, I think.
Okay, Jordan Johncock. More of your questions for Donald to come. 239-1070 on the Talk of Gasoline Alley. This is 1070 The Fan.
Listen to 1070.
In what you pay, but what it will cost. Today's tight budgets demand more value. With Indiana's Union Construction Trades.
Ends. Oh, any minute now here on 1070 The Fan. I think the pre-race show will begin at 6 a.m. on Sunday morning, but in reality, it's going to begin at 10:30 the night before with the all-night race party with Mike Sarawick, conversations with the likes of Donald, I believe Scott Goodyear is among the guests, some other people too. He's replaying the 92 and the 67 races. And also, there will be a special edition of Trackside the night before the 500 from 6 until 8 p.m. So join us as we get you set for the greatest spectacle in racing. Your questions for Donald now, and Tad is up next. Tad, thanks for hanging on.
Hey, thanks, guys. I appreciate talking with you. I was wondering if Donald could give us a little story on the driver, Spider Webb.
Sure.
Maybe what his given name was and maybe why he qualified but didn't start in 1949.
Oh, all right. Sure. First name was Travis. And where the Spider, I suppose, was an obvious nickname. But he told me, I did meet him, and he said that one time a publicist wanted to call him Cobb. And he said, no, I'll go with Spider. I'll go with Spider but not Cobb. The 1949 story was that they broke a transmission on the morning of the race. Now, what they used to do in those days, if a car couldn't start, they would put an alternate in. But it was kind of late, and on race morning, they discovered that the transmission had broken, and they didn't have time to fix it. And so the agreement with the officials were that he would get 33rd place rather than put in the first alternate starter. His years at the track, 1948 was the first year, and he'd been around for a while, and I want to say that he was probably about 37, 38 years old at that time, and which was about the time that a lot of drivers would be retiring, and he'd been running dirt tracks for years, and I asked him about that also, how come you waited so long to come, because he was a very accomplished sprint car driver, and he said, because I was making more money doing the short tracks, and he said, instead of hanging out at Indianapolis for a month, he said, I could probably pack, you know, 6-8 races in that time and be traveling around and making appearance money and everything. So anyway, he never did have a finish. He had 6 starts, and 48 was the first one. In fact, there's a little footnote on him. He actually, a number of listeners will be familiar with Mutt Anderson, who owned a sprint car for several years that Roger McCluskey drove, and Mutt's still living in Xenia, Ohio, and I think he's like 93 or 94 years old now. Well, anyway, he had a car that he entered in 1948 called the Anderson Special, which he wanted to drive himself, but Spider Webb drove the car. He qualified and got bumped, and then he got into another car owned by Lou and Bruce Bromley, and he qualified that, and he is the first person to get bumped and then come back and qualify another car. And the fact that he was able to do that at the last minute, he then had kind of a reputation for being able to come and be a late qualifier on the last day. So that happened several times where he didn't even plan on coming to the track, and he would get the call, can you come up and get this thing in the show? And he would show up and with very few laps would get it in the race. But really his forte was sprint car racing, and he was the Midwest sprint car champion in 1948. And he was still, 1955 was when he last was at the Speedway and waved off a run that actually would have been fast enough to make it. And when I met him was in 1973 when he came back for the Winchester Old Timers. And if I can just insert myself in this one as well, when I met him, in fact, I'm getting chills thinking about it now. I thought, well, I'm going to meet this crusty old guy because, I mean, I knew that he was, you know, heavy drinker and of the old school. He didn't work out at a gym. And in fact, he used to, at a sprint race, I've been told this several times, I mean, he would show up with a hangover. And then they would, in fact, I think he told me this. He was driving for Johnny Vance Sr. And they'd say, well, you know, we're going to go out. Are you ready? We're going to hot lap. And he said, why are we going to hot lap? You know,
I'm ready.
We don't get paid. Let me know when wake me up when it's time to qualify. And then he would go out and set a track record.
Well, I think that's Bruno Junqueira today. He
pretty
did,
much,
he
yeah.
did two quick laps yesterday, and he said, next year I think I'll just take it out and put it in line.
But he didn't show up with a hangover, though.
No, I don't think so.
No, I don't think so. But anyway, so when he came to Eldora, Johnny Vance Jr. brought him to Eldora for the first of the four Crown Nationals. And that's where I met him, and I thought, you know, I wonder how this guy, because this is a tough guy, I don't know how, you know, will he be pleasant or will this be an awkward moment? And he said, oh, yes. He said, in fact, thank you for mentioning me on the radio broadcast, because he was one of the guys that was still listening to the broadcast. And evidently, there must have been 1 year when somebody was having problems getting going, and I had mentioned Spiderweb did not start in 1949. It never occurred to me, you know, that Spiderweb was listening and that I would learn that years later. There's a lot of rewards, and I'm sure you've had some too, where there's something that you've said on the air, and then maybe somebody comments to you later, and you never, you know, it just brings it back into reality where you thought, golly, there's actually people listening. There's people listening. Wow.
That is the goal. It doesn't always happen, but that's the goal. Tad, thanks for your call.
Hey, thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
239-1070 is the telephone number. It's the talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan with Donald Davidson. This is the talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan with Donald Davidson. I'm Kevin Lee. Trackside with Kevin and Kevin is coming up after 7, recapping qualifications for the Indianapolis 500. Larry, thanks for your patience.
Oh, you're welcome.
Hi, Larry.
Hi, Donald. I said I had one question. I actually have two. The first is I'd like to hear a little bit about John Martin.
Okay.
I kept trying to think of his name the other day, and finally you said he tackled Jim Herdebees. That's the guy I've been trying to remember his name. But the second is I had a friend that gave me a pit pass, which made my entire racing fandom just go sky high. He gave me a pit pass 1 year, Bob Moorhead.
Yes.
He has some connection with USAC.
He did.
And if it's okay with you guys, I'm going to hang up and listen.
Okay, Bob Moorhead first. He passed away, I think it was last year, and he was the longtime chairman of the board of the United States Auto Club for, oh, golly, since 69 or 70, I think it was. Maybe not quite that quick. I know that's when he came onto the board, I think, in 68, but he did become chairman of the board very quickly. Anyway, he was also the head of the Indiana National Guard, commanding general. And he was very much of a racing enthusiast. He had a company on North College called Central Publishing Company, which I think was started by his father. And so I used to go there quite a bit. And, in fact, I mean, he was, I guess I'm almost kind of doing a tribute. He was just a thoroughly nice man and very unpretentious, although he had all kinds of, political connections. And normally, I was thinking about him yesterday because on Armed Forces Day, he would be Senator Lugar's escort. I mean, that was for every year until just about the last two or three years when he could no longer come out. But I was in the Indiana National Guard, not through him, but I was in the Guard. And I remember that he would come to Camp Grayling is where we were stationed, or at least we weren't at Camp Grayling proper. I was in the aviation battalion, and we'd be at the airfield, which was downtown. Sounds like it would be the other way around. Anyway, we would do like a simulated we'd camp out in the woods in little pop tents and had these sort of makeshift foxholes and everything. And one day this Jeep comes down the path and, there he is. And the Jeep stopped and the two fellows get off and, you know, they're saluting with both hands and there's the general. And he was actually looking for me. Because of me working at USAC. Well, I was a PFC, and I hadn't even shaved that morning. But he came down and just exchanged pleasantries, and he just was just a very, very regular guy. And so, and then also he was on all kinds of boards. He kind of reminded me of Tom Binford in that respect, in that he couldn't turn down, you know, he was either coming from a meeting or going to one, and I don't know how he kept it all straight, but he just was a super man, and very much, I used to call him the eternal optimist. John Martin, I'll quickly do him. He was at the Speedway from 1971 until, that was when he took his rookie test. He went until 81 was the last year that he was in a car. The years that he qualified were 72, 73, 74, 75, and 76. The best finish was 8th in 73, and then in 70, and that was the year of the all kinds of problems, but he was a survivor and got 8th. And then in 74, he was 11th, and one of my favorite car names, well, actually, in 72 and 73, he didn't have a sponsor, so the car ran as the unsponsored special. And then in 74, he had a sponsor, and this I always love this one, Sea Snack Shrimp Cocktail Special, and he finished 11th. And then in 76, it was the Dave McIntyre Chevy Ford Special, which was Dave McIntyre was the car dealer. And then he missed it a couple of times with the American Kids Racer. Anyway, the first time he ran USAC was stock cars, and he had quite a diversified background because he drove sports cars and he drove stock cars and could drive a stock car on a road course and then ran the Indianapolis cars. He did a lot of his own mechanical work. And if he might be listening, because I know that he's worked on several teams just recently as a spotter and just working as a crew guy, and nobody realizes that's a guy that drove in the 500 several times. But he's one of the drivers with one of the finest voices I've ever heard, and I don't mean this, and I don't want this to come out wrong. He had exceptionally strong voice. He's one of three or four drivers that I felt that if they had wanted to do it, they could have, it was not quite Carnegie-type pipes, but close. Just a really rich voice that if he worked at it, he could have done voiceovers.
Want to sneak in Donald with us. Hello, Donald. You're up with Donald.
Gentlemen, how you doing tonight?
Fine.
Going to be fairly quick, but I do have several things I want to get in quickly. One, did Gordon Johncock ever do the radio driver analyst thing?
Yes, he did.
But he was good at it, too.
He did. I think he did it about three times. I know 85, in fact, the year when he retired, he actually worked race day. And I think he did, it might have only been a couple because he did come back and run. But, yes, he was good. And I remember hearing he did Pocono one year when he didn't have a ride, which I think is what, you know, showed that he would be good on the 500 broadcast.
Yeah, I've got an opinion and a question.
I've
heard of many of these, and one of my favorites was Freddie Agabation.
Yes.
And I'll tell you what I think about him. Mm-hmm. He, Rocky Marciano was announcing boxing matches at that time, and those two were very similar in their way. They didn't pull any punches. They were very straightforward. They might only say 50 words, but they could cram more into those 50 words than I could cram into 300.
I didn't know Marciano ever did that.
Yes, he did. He did boxing on the radio in the 50s and 60s before
his
unfortunate death. But I thought Agabation was a lot like him in that he could really get to the point quickly and let you know what he was talking about and what he meant to say.
He could articulate very well and use some words that you wouldn't normally hear out of a race driver.
He was so good. Was Maury Rose the very first driver analyst?
Yes, he was. Very good. 1955.
I thought it was absolutely nuts that they had him run up to the pagoda to do his bit, and then down, and then up, and then down. Why wouldn't they give him a seat in the booth? He wasn't young by any means.
I thought he was in the booth.
Well, the first broadcast he did, he sounded terribly out of breath. And Sid was saying to him, now come back and do this in 45.
All right, then.
It just seems weird. They wouldn't give him a seat. They made him running back and forth.
I've never heard the whole broadcast, but yes, he was the driver analyst in 55.
But it's, you know, by 58 with Agabation, they had him sitting right up there with
winner. Earlier, I got a call in a previous program about the oldest car to run in the race, not win. And that was 21 years old, but we didn't have any winner that old. So I would say George Robson's 1946 winner. And as far as Mark Donahue, I'll try to just do a short one on this. Obviously, 1972 winner. First appeared at the Speedway in 69, and all of his 500 starts were with Roger Penske. He was seventh in 69 as a rookie, and won the Rookie of the Year award. But was that a cruise to seventh place? No, he actually was running third at one point, and there was quite a lot of mechanical problems that year and people fixing their cars and getting them back in the race. And I believe that he had a turbocharger problem, and I think the stop was something like 20 minutes, but he was still able to get in and finish seventh. But he did run third for quite some time. In 70, he was runner-up to Al Unser. Then in 71, came to the track and stamped himself as the clear favorite to win the pole and probably the race, and it ended up neither. He got knocked off the pole, and that's a long story. I won't go into that, but he did start second, knocked off the pole by Peter Revson, and then led the early stages and was just pulling away, and then had a transmission problem which knocked him out. And I think, ironically, it was 66 laps that he completed. Then 72 was his fourth start, and he won the race. 73 was his final start at Indianapolis, and he drove an Eagle, not a McLaren, as he had in 71, 72. He started on the outside of the front row and dropped out shortly before the race was finally stopped at 133 laps, so his final ranking was 15th. At the end of the year, he announced his retirement, and I'm really not giving him fair due here for all of his victories with the Trans Am and the Can-Am series. And then, but he did announce his retirement at the end of the 73 season. His final race was to be the finale of the first IROC series at Daytona in 74, which he won. And then he went into retirement, but he was out very shortly to drive Penske's Formula One car at the Canadian and U.S. Grand Prix of 74, rather. And then 75, he went to Europe. And then on the morning of the Austrian Grand Prix, he was hot lapping, had an accident, and appeared to be not injured, except he was complaining of a headache. They didn't take him to the hospital. They brought him back to the pits. Shortly thereafter, he collapsed in the pits, and then he passed away on Thursday. So that's kind of a quick version on Mark Donohue, but we wanted to try and cram it in rather than make a two-parter, because we do have other callers and we would like to get to them. But we do appreciate you calling in. I run a little bit behind now, so we've got to take a break here. The number to call is 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. You are listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana.
As a business person, you see things not only in what you pay, but what it will cost. Today's tight budgets.
Nature about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. 1-800-603-6453. 1-800-603-6453. And let's go to Jerry, and this is probably Jerry from Delphi. Good evening.
Yeah, good evening, Donald.
Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Good. I'd like to know if you'd profile Shorty Templeton for me, please.
Okay, sure. Shorty Templeton's forte was USAC Midgets, AAA before that. And I'll do Indianapolis, but let's touch on the Midgets first. He was from the Pacific Northwest, Seattle, and came back to the Midwest. I think 54 is the first year that he ran. And I think he was third in Midget points under AAA in 54, behind Jack Turner and Rex Easton. I didn't know I was going to do this. And then I think he was runner-up in 55 behind Jack Turner, which was the final year for AAA, and then USAC came in, and then for the first 3 years of USAC, he was the champion. He was the national champion in 1956, and also was he the Midwest champ as well, and then in 57, he won all three, 57 or 58, he won all three of the major midget championships, which was the National Championship, the Midwest Championship, and the Pacific Coast. And he won the National Championship in 56, 57, and 58. One of those years, I think it was 57 when he won all three. Anyway, as far as Indianapolis 500 is concerned, he ran sprint cars a little bit, by the way, but not a great deal. Indianapolis, his first year was 1955, and he started out with the Pete Wales Westwood Tool and Gate Special, which he got out of,
and qualified the Central Excavating Special, and he dropped out. He finished 18th, so I'll have to guess the lap count. It was probably, about 140 laps or something like that. In 56, he drove for Lee Glessner, but he did not qualify. And then on the night before the 500, he had that amazing run. And I know we've talked about the fact that Indianapolis had the West 16th Street Midget Speedway, which was right across from the track. And they used to run three separate programs the day and night before the 500, and where they would just they ran a complete program. And after the feature, they'd clear out the grandstands and pick up the trash and then immediately start selling tickets to the next program. And they did that three times. And so when they came back for the second program, you didn't line up according to how you finished in the first feature. They hot-lapped and ran heats again and time trials and everything. Anyway, what was remarkable was that he won all three features. He won the afternoon 100-lapper, the evening 150-lapper, and then the final 100-lapper, which would checker normally around 2:30 in the morning. And then the bomb went off at 5 o'clock, and then the Indianapolis Speedway opened. Anyway, he did that in 56. Did not run in the 500 the next day. 57, he wasn't entered. Then in 58, he practiced with the Peter Schmidt special, but ended up qualifying the McNamara special. He got involved in the first lap accident. And rather than go into all of that, he sustained body damage, but kept running for quite a while, and then ended up finishing 19th. Lap count would have been right around 100, I guess. 59, he was in several different cars, missed the show. The closest that he got, he was in the Frank Arciero Maserati. The closest that he got was with the Braun Plywood special, which did miss the show, but he was the second alternate starter. In 60, he drove the Federal Engineering special and was running 8th when he dropped out very close to the end of the race. And then in 61, with the Bill Forbes Racing Team special, he finished 4th. Foyt won it. Eddie Sachs was 2nd. Roger Ward was 3rd. Shorty Templeman was 4th. And then in 62, he drove a Watson, with Bill Forbes' car, but a newer one than the one that he'd run in 61. And he actually had an unofficial 150-mile-an-hour lap on the morning of the first qualifying day, but couldn't get it when it came to do the official time trials. He spun out at one point, lost a lot of time, but was still running. In fact, did complete the distance in 11th place. Later that year, he was fatally injured in a midget race in August at Marion, Ohio. And what he gained his greatest fame with was where he met his demise, running the midgets. He never won a national championship race, but he did have several seconds and thirds and fourths in 61, driving the Bill Forbes special with Dave Laycock as the chief mechanic. Anyway, Jerry, thank you very much indeed. And once again, we really do support, thank you for your support of this program. We're going to have to take another break, so callers, hang on, and we'll be back in just a few moments. You are listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. And so we'll go straight to the phones and go to Dave. Good evening, sir. What would you like to hear about?
Good evening, Donald. How you doing?
Fine, sir.
Two things, if you have time. My main one is, could you tell us a little bit about Clarence Kegel? He was kind of Tony Holman's get-her-done guy there.
Absolutely, yep.
And the second thing, if you have a little time, I noticed from like 45 almost to mid-80s on race day, people of, you know, significant importance, not all of them, but some of them, always had a badge 99.
Yes.
This is before the lanterns and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just touch on that a little, if you would?
Yeah, I think the 1 and the 99 were I don't really know what the difference between those two were. Did the numbers go all the way from 1 to 99? No, and I'm really not very good on it, but I think there's an 11 and there was a 15. I think there was probably only maybe a half a dozen different numbers, but the 1 and the 99 was effectively the same thing, and you had to have a bronze badge to go with it. And one on race day, one didn't work without the other. You had to have the silver badge and the backing card with the 1 or the 99. If you had a bronze, then I don't think you would have had either one of those, I don't think. But basically, it got you anywhere, and you're right. That was the heart credential, which was the participants had them, but then also the VIP types had. Clarence Cagle was his role in the making the Speedway what it is pretty major. He was the superintendent of the grounds. When he first got that position, I think it was 48 or 49. He was a Holman and Company employee, and there was a fellow named Jack Fortner was the superintendent of the grounds, and I think he passed away at around that time, and that's when Clarence then it could have been as late as 51, but certainly by 51, Clarence was the superintendent of the grounds, and for many years, of course, we only had one race a year, and in fact, the officers, until 1956, were downtown on North Capitol, and they didn't do anything at the track other than the tire test, but there was no museum, and there was no bus rides around the track or anything like that, and Clarence sort of pretty much had the grounds. So he kept the place in tip-top shape, and he took great pride in getting the track cleaned up as quickly as possible, and the people used to leave a lot of trash, way more than they do now, and within a day or two, he'd have it all cleaned up. And then into the mid-50s, more and more of the teams would use they'd use the garage area for their headquarters for the championship season. I don't think that generally was known, but you could go over there anytime during the summer on a Tuesday or Wednesday, and all of the top people in championship racing would be in the garage area. Well, all of that came under Clarence, and he had to put up with a lot of practical jokes and things of that nature. And the 1956 was, they called that the year of Cagle's miracle, because there was a heavy rainstorms in the days leading up to the race, and the track got flooded. I mean, it rained so hard, and the creeks broke their banks, and you didn't have the system that you have now, where a number of channels are being cut to prevent a flood. Well, in those days, I mean, the streets around Speedway would flood down at the corner of 16th and Cunningham, and so the creek through turn one would break its banks, and the water would come up onto the track and down into the tunnels and everything. And in 1956, a day or two before the race, it looked like you couldn't have the race. And he had the pumps out there, and I don't think he went to bed for like 3 days. And on race morning, it was amazing. People were coming to the track under overcast skies, and they were just pumping out the final few pints of water. And that was known as the year of Cagle's miracle. He also did a lot of work around the town of Speedway, and then he started becoming involved with other tracks. Tony Holman would loan him out. So when Michigan was being built, and even Daytona, and for several winters, he would help the France family. And a couple of times I went to the Daytona 500, and we would leave a little early. We tried to beat the rush, so we'd leave at like the 400-mile mark by road, and we'd come out, and here's Clarence Cagle directing the traffic. So he just was an amazing man, and we thank you for asking about him, because he doesn't really get a whole lot of credit, but he was greatly respected within the racing fraternity. All right, we do have to take another break. Thank you very much, Dave. Paul, Donald, Rhea, you hang on. We'll try and get to all of you. We'll be back with more of the Talk of Gasoline Alley right after this. We are back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley. We'll be here until 8 o'clock tonight, and then tomorrow and Wednesday. And sadly, I can't believe it's time already, but Wednesday will be our final show for this season on Network Indiana. But we do appreciate everybody who has been kind enough to call in. And for those of you that listened, if you enjoyed what you were hearing and you are picking this up on a station that is in your area, you might want to call the station during business hours and thank them for carrying it. And maybe we can be back again with you next year. But anyway, we do quickly go back to the phones because we've got several callers hanging on. We want to try and get to everybody. So, Donald, you are next. Thank you for calling.
Yes, Donald. Could you do a profile on Ray Pixley, please?
Yes, sure. That won't take very long because he drove once and finished sixth. That was 1936. I've had people ask me about him before. I don't know. Would that have been you?
No, sir.
Oh, okay, then. He was, well, I have been asked about him. In fact, I remember that my first year at the track was 1964, And I was in the Pardelli Jones garage, I think. Gil Morales. It was either Foyt's garage or Pardelli's garage, and one of the Morales brothers in there, and he asked me about Ray Pixley. And when I said, well, you know, he finished, drove the Fink Auto Special for Paul Weyrich in 1936 and finished sixth. And then his next question was, how many drivers drove in the 500 that ran once and got a top 10 finish? And in his case, a top six finish. There's not a lot known about Ray Pixley. He came from Washington, and I can't remember what town it was in Washington State, but he did go down to Southern California and drove at Legion Ascot, and I think he was fifth in points in AAA on the West Coast in 35. Was he fourth or fifth in points? Anyway, in 36, he did come with Paul Weyrich, and this was a very famous car, and as the Fink Auto Special, which was a local car dealer, he did drive the full 500 miles and finished in sixth place. And he didn't survive much longer because he lost his life at Roby Speedway, which I would say Chicago, except it was actually in Indiana. See if I can remember the address. Was it 115th and Indianapolis Avenue or something like that? Anyway, if you are going from Indiana up to Chicago, when you get to, is it 80, I think, that goes east and west, just before you get to, when you're on the freeway, just right at the border, when you get to Indianapolis Avenue, to the north, just a matter of yards is where the Roby Speedway was, and that's where he met his demise. I wanted to say Paliute, Washington, but it's not that. It's just not coming to me right now, but it was Washington State. And I'm not sure if he was ever married. I think his mother was his next of kin when he lost his life. But I think he might have won a couple of races at Legion Ascot, but I do know that he did pile up the points and did have that one good finish. I think fifth in points, and I'm just repeating what I said there. But anyway, thank you very much for asking, because I love to do those colorful guys from the 20s and 30s that just basically came in and had one start. And it's too bad that it ends the way that it did, but unfortunately that was not uncommon in those days. The mortality rate, sadly, was very high. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Donald.
Thank you for the question. And let's go to Rhea from Dayton, Ohio.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm good.
Good. I think you had a trouble getting in a couple of nights, but you're on now, so what would you like to hear about?
I was listening to the first part of Kevin and Kevin right after 7 o'clock because I was trying to figure out. I was listening yesterday to all the craziness with the bump day and all that, and I was trying to kind of refresh my memory on what happened.
Okay.
Has anybody been bumped more than twice?
No. Well, actually, yes. Mark Smith
got bumped three times, and I thought, "Oh, geez."
No, Mark. Well, the term what bumping means is something different now to what it used to mean, because it used to mean you couldn't get bumped until after the field was full. No, I think twice is it. I know Mark Smith was awfully close in. I'm struggling a little bit now. Mark Smith was at the track for 2 years, and he qualified and got bumped, and qualified and got bumped again. And I think he was thinking, he was pretty close to going out and qualifying again, but which he did not. So it's got to be nobody more than twice. And I can tell you, Jimmy McElreath had that happen in 1971. Len Sutton had that happen in 1963. That's the only ones I can think of at the moment that got bumped twice. But being bumped more than once now, as I say, means something different over the last 4 or 5 years from what it used to mean. I mean, when the not to get too complicated with this thing, but when 11-11-11 came in, you could be bumped after you had 11 qualifiers, and it used to mean that you couldn't get bumped until after you had the 33.
Yeah. Has anybody finished last more than 1 year in his career at Indianapolis?
Yeah. Salt Walther from over your way.
Oh, okay.
Salt Walther from Dayton, North Carrollton, actually, I think, or, which is basically the same thing, right? I mean, it is North Carrollton, I think, is a suburb?
West Carrollton.
Yeah, West Carrollton, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Anyway, Salt was 33rd in 1972, 1973, and 1975.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for calling in, and let's take a break here. Yeah, all right, we'll take a break, and we'll try and get to more callers when we get back. If you'd like to try and get into yet tonight, the number to call is 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. You're listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network in tomorrow night and Wednesday night from 7 until 8. With the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana, and that Wednesday night, unfortunately, will be our final show. So, we'd like to thank everybody that was kind enough to listen and to call in, and a very faithful listener is Paul from Racine, Wisconsin. And Paul, I believe that's you that's hanging on to come up next.
That would be me, Donald.
That
How
would
are
be you?
You.
Great.
Good. Hey, I hate to hear you say those words. You know, the last couple shows, but you know, do appreciate it, Donald. Donald, I don't know how much time we have here. I think we're running up against it.
We've got several minutes.
Okay, can you do Jim Hall?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Jim Hall actually was sort of kind of winding down his career when he came to the Speedway for the first time, because it was not until 1978. So he was legendary 20 years before that with the Chaparral sports cars, and I don't know really when Jim Hall first came in, you know, really into the scene, or the major scene, but probably around 60, because he did a season of Formula One, 1963, so he'd been around for a while then, and he did 1 year I can't remember what the heck he drove. It was a Lotus, but it was a privately entered team. And I wanted to say British Racing Partnership, but I'm not quite sure that that's it. But he did score points. He was fifth in the German Grand Prix, and in those days points only went six deep. So I think fifth in the German Grand Prix and sixth in the British, I think, because he did score 3 points. But he just did the one season, and then came back to the United States, and was developing the Chaparral sports cars. Then Chaparral won the 1,000 kilometers of the Nürburgring and it was Phil Hill and Joachim Bonnier, I think, and that was 66, I believe. But anyway, he was driving 64, 65. He was running before you had the Can-Am Series. There was the United States Road Racing Championship, and he and Hap Sharp drove Chaparrals. And anyway, just then it was in the Can-Am Series. He developed several revolutionary cars. The J2 vacuum cleaner was probably the most controversial, and Jackie Stewart drove that one. That was had. Rotor blades at the back, and this is a little hard to explain, but these electric battery-powered rotors would spin in opposite direction and suck the air out from underneath the car so that it would suck to the track. And finally, that was no longer eligible. As far as Indianapolis is concerned, 1978 was the first year. The first National City Travelers Check Chaparral that was actually a Lola with ground effects, with skirts on the side, with Al Unser. And Al Unser won the 500, first time out. In fact, they only ran selected races that year, and they won, and this a lot of people found this hard to believe, they won the Indianapolis 500, the Pocono 500, and the Ontario 500. The big three 500.
And I think the only ones, too. to have won the Triple Crown?
He won all three in the same year, and he didn't win the championship. It was won by Tom Sneaver, who did not have a victory. And there was some criticism over that, except that in defense of it, it was like a 17 or 18 race series, and Al and Jim Hull only ran selected races, but there was a USAC came under fire for its point system, because how could a guy win the championship with no wins? And several different world-class point systems were applied, including Formula One, motorcycles, NASCAR, and several others. And in all of them, Tom Sneaver still came out as the champion. But anyway, back to Jim Hull. In 79, he came out with the John Barnard design car that became known as the Yellow Submarine. And in 79, it was Al Unser. He qualified for the outside of the front row, but dominated the first half until dropping out just like right after the halfway mark. And then to everyone's surprise, Al came to a parting of the ways with Jim Hull, and Al went to Bobby Hillen's Longhorn Racers. And Johnny Rutherford had just got pink slipped by McLaren, who had shut down and never did come back. And so that released Rutherford. So then he took over the Yellow Submarine and won the 1980 Indianapolis 500. So Jim Hull had won twice in his first three starts. Then in 91, it was John Andretti who finished fifth, which is his best finish. And then in 92, it was John Andretti again, finishing eighth. And then I'm trying to think what happened in 93 and 94. I think Jim Hull didn't come back, but he did return in 1995. And believe it or not, his driver was Gilles Deferrin, who made his debut in 1995. And then there was an accident going to the first turn. Well, it was the Eddie Cheever and Stan Fox accident, but it also took out Gilles Deferrin, and Lynn St. James was involved in that, and so was Carlos Guerrero, who was not related to Roberto Guerrero. But anyway, Deferrin lost a wheel. In fact, the suspension broke off, and he managed to make it round to the pits, and they attempted to fix it in the pit area for quite some time before they finally withdrew. And when they pushed that car away, that was the final time that a Jim Hull car would be at the Speedway. And I'm trying to think what he must have had a partnership with somebody in 93 or 94, but it's not coming to me right now. But I think if you said to most people, I don't know that they really associate him with Indianapolis Motor Speedway, I think most people would think of Jim Hull with the chaparrals, with the wings on the stilts, with the adjustable, the high-mounted wings that you could adjust from the driver's cockpit. They finally did away with that. The SECA did away with that. And he did actually come to the Speedway. I don't know if that's generally known. He bought the chaparral before they had the high-mounted wings. He bought a chaparral to the track in 1965, and he was trying out automatic transmission. And I don't know why you would try out automatic transmission at the Indianapolis Speedway, but he did run it. And here's the trivia. They did run some laps in the opposite direction, going from north up the main straightaway, which really looked weird. But anyway, Paul, thank you very much indeed for call. And I'm glad that we got everybody in. We've got just a few seconds now to kind of wrap up and say that we will be back again tomorrow night at 7 o'clock with the talk of Gasoline Alley. But now thanks to Tony Donahue, and we've been kidding him about being Mark Donahue's cousin. He's the on-site producer here. And thanks, everybody, for listening. If you just, we'll really quickly give you the number for tomorrow night, because we'd love to hear from you. It is 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. This has been the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Good night, everybody.